This is Damien O'Doherty with Center Maryland's The Lobby. We are here with a guest that is the most renowned lobbyist in state circle. And I tell you, when I was just starting out as a staff member in the state Senate in 1997, I remember the Daily Record listed Jerry Evans, front page. You were the man then, you are the man now. Welcome to Center Maryland's The Lobby Pod.
Thank you. It's an honor. I feel like I've made it now that I'm on your show. So thank you. No, it's a great, you do great work. And, you know, we've had such a decline really in the kind of the press in the last 10 years in Annapolis, but had some growth in some of the sheets and stuff, Maryland Matters, and there's a great Maryland Report, but you guys do a great job in bringing some of the issues to the fore. So I appreciate that.
Thank you. Talk to me a little bit, like, what's it like to be Jerry Evans and wake up and attack the day? I know it seems to me that you're a little bit like me, an early riser. Talk to me about how you prepare for the day as Maryland's top lobbyist.
Well, the first thing you've got to do is you got to get some exercise, you know, particularly at my age. You know, you youngsters have a little more kind of room to get ready for aging, but it just turned 65. So it's real important to get some exercise in the morning. And we're lucky we've got a Peloton, which I'm addicted to downstairs. So there's no excuse for not jumping on it, even when our 24-hour gym closed. So that's the first thing you need to do. And I think that having a great family as a safety net, you know, I don't have to tell you because you've been at the pinnacle for years and years, but politics can do things to you, to some of our elected folks. You know, they get a sense that they don't put their pants on one leg at a time anymore. And that can leak into family situations. So we try not to let that happen. We have a wonderful family. Kath and I have been married for 40 years now, and try to understand that that's what's important. And watching you, I enjoyed so much your Facebook stuff with your family, and yearned to be back in Aspen. I should have hooked up when we were there last year with you, but we were on kind of a crazy schedule. But so having that is what's important, I think. And you know, if your family's in good shape, you can face the day without kind of those ancillary problems that arise sometimes with too much work.
You got into this business as a staff person for the Judicial Proceedings Committee, and the chairman that time was Mike Miller. Was that your first gig in politics?
No. I mean, it was, I got started in 1976 as an intern for then Victor L. Crawford from Montgomery County. You remember him? He was a great Senate chair of the Montgomery County Senate delegation. It's just so happened my sister-in-law worked for him as a lawyer. He had a great firm in Rockville. And so I got an internship with Victor working the Montgomery County issues for the local delegation.
You were the staff guy for the Montgomery County delegation. Mine as working for the city senators. That's a great training ground.
Yeah, it was great. It was a great group of senators, Peggy Schweinhout, people like that. Charlie Gilchrist. That's how I met Charlie Gilchrist, who then went on. I helped him run his campaign for county executive in 78.
Was he the saint that everybody says he, you know, I know Jim, and I heard all about his dad, not from Jim, but people would always talk about Charlie Gilchrist as this really sainted sort of figure.
He was just, as you know, we were involved in this, you and I, probably for the people that we meet and the relationships we forge. Charlie was just all the good things that you've heard about. He was a wonderful father and husband, a brilliant mind, Harvard Law School, Williams College. But you talk to him and he's the everyman, the guy next door. Wonderful wife, Phoebe. And he had that transformational issue in his life that, again, I hate to go back to family, but his son, I was at a concert with his son the night he developed these terrible symptoms where he couldn't hear. We were at the Cars concert and and he couldn't see. And next day's at Georgetown discovering a inoperable brain tumor. And he went through an operation, which was not a terrible success. And then they tried some experimental thing. Damon, I don't know what it was, but whatever it was, it worked. And Donald at the time was going to Williams College like his dad and had to take off for this. But the good news is he made a complete recovery. The brain tumor, even to this day, he's great, got kids, married. The brain tumor against all odds was eradicated. And I think, and again, I don't know for sure, but I think Charlie made a deal with God. He said, look, if you save my son, I'm going to join the priesthood. And he did. His son was recovered. And this guy, I mean, he could have done anything, you know, governor. I mean, he had it all. And he joined the Episcopal priesthood and became a, he worked in a drug rehab. I remember in the convention, where did we go? Where was the Democratic convention in Chicago? What year? Whatever, 90s. Anyway, we went to see his drug rehab center. Paul Sarbanes and he were in the same law firm and were great friends. So we took a Maryland delegation out to see Charlie's work at this drug rehab center. And then he came, he was scheduled to come back to the parish in Washington and then got pancreatic cancer and was dead within a year. So, but it was that that relationship with his son and that what he describes as a miraculous recovery that caused him to go out of politics and into the priesthood. And previously, Charlie was, you know, he went to St. Albans, so it's an Episcopal, wonderful school. And he was, you know, pretty much irreverent, you know, about religion and such. So to make that leap really was a life, obviously, altering kind of change.
So when you're working for the Montgomery County delegation, we got some young listeners here. I think they would appreciate this. You're working for the Montgomery County delegation. And where do you see yourself? You see yourself sort of like, I could get into politics. Maybe I'll get into the game itself, electoral politics. Maybe I'll be a staff person. What was the view of the field for you like at that age? And where did you see yourself ending up?
You know, I just love the folks in the process. And as you know, you get the bug or you don't. And I got bit. And I knew that I wanted to be involved in this at this level because, you know, you get a little exposure to the federal system. And although, thank God, things are moving briskly now. But as you know, things last years and you meet with staff people, you never really meet with members. And I just didn't see that as a role on either side, staff or lobbying. But
you were from that part of the world. I think when you're from the Washington area, it takes a little of the glamour out. out of Washington.
Yeah. And you realize when you work in Annapolis, how important the decisions that are made on every person's life every day, from you know, where we drive to how we drive to the schools we send our kids to. So I just knew I wanted to be part of that process and worked in it for 10 years on the staff side before, as Mike Miller would say, before I went to the dark side and started lobbying. So yeah, 10 years I worked for Charlie Gilchrist, for Victor, worked for Mike Miller. He became chairman of JPR in 82, worked for him for 4 years on that committee. And then when he became president, I ventured out and became a lobbyist.
So for over three decades, really been at the top of, in Maryland, of course, there's one list that comes out. It's the money list, and you're either number one or you're not. And you have been at the top of that list more than any person that I've ever seen. What kind of toll does that take on you through the years? You feel like you got to always be number one. You feel like, you know, the list doesn't do you justice. Talk to me about your relationship with being number one. I know you got some highly competitive kids that have done some amazing things. I'm sure they got some of that from you, but it's got to take a big toll to be at the center of things for so long.
Yeah, you know, I have a good conscience here sitting behind me who, when you said, does it take a toll? And I heard her say, uh-huh. Because to most folks, the numbers are meaningless, Damien. They're meaningless. I mean, that group of 10 lobbyists, the so-called top 10 or so, you could hire any one of them and they would do a wonderful job for you. Whether it's Tim, Bruce, Lisa, Nick Manis, you go right down the list and they're all fine lobbyists and fine people. The numbers themselves really are worthless. And I think you're going to see, you know, what I'm trying to do is, and it doesn't take much doing, but, you know, look, there's a next generation out there. And part of our, I think our charge is to get that next generation ready for taking up the mantle. And that's Haley. I mean, she's smarter than I am. She's better looking, of course. And people like her more than they like me. I mean, so, you know, I want to start handing things off to her. She's doing everything now anyway. But as you know, in this business, there's nothing unlike your business, which, you know, you guys have the cream of the crop. You've got a cadre of clients any firm would die for. But you have an equity that's above and beyond your name and Steve's. We don't, you know, we don't have anything to sell but ourselves. So if we're going to continue this, and Haley's hopefully going to continue it, you have to get the next generation ready to take on the task. And I think she is. So I'd like to see myself eventually, you know, do less and maybe drop more in the list and have her come into the list if the list means anything at all.
You know, when I came into this stuff in 1997, which was, sounds like it's about 20 plus years after you did, highly competitive environment. I mean, you know, I felt like it was a lot less sterile than Washington, very highly competitive environment in every conceivable way. But there was a humanity about the competitiveness in state circle. And I can't imagine sort of like constantly showing up and constantly being in the center of things for 40 years. I've tried to be an insider. I've tried to be an outsider. What has changed? You feel like we're getting into a more collaborative kind of culture in state circle? It seems like it's, I don't know if it's the social media or the less of a hierarchy, but there seems to be sort of more sharing and partnering than when I first got into the game. I'd love to hear your point of view on how the culture is moving in the State House lobbying corps over your career.
Yeah, I think that, look, at one point, you know, when you and I were down there, we remember when there was basically one lobbyist, right? I mean, and it goes back even before Jim Doyle. There was a gentleman, and I can't remember his name, but I think he worked for BG. I'm not sure, but he literally sat on the floor of the State House of the chambers and lobbied. So you've seen quite a change, obviously. But I remember watching Jim Doyle with his perfectly fitting suit and his beautiful white hair combed straight back, and give these eloquent arguments about bills, but not involved in politics at all. And right. it wasn't Jim's thing. He wasn't, he may go to fundraisers here or there, but you've seen a transition. And then Bruce comes along and Bruce took it to a different level
you saw Bruce come into the game while you were a staff guy.
Yeah. So I saw Bruce come on. And of course, Jim was still there. God bless him. And, but you know, Bruce took it a different level. It was the eloquent arguments and the passion that only Bruce has. But then it was the involvement in politics that of the fundraising and doing all of those things that lobbyists had done then. And then, you know, frankly, then there was kind of a catharsis where the legislature said, wait a minute, we don't want you guys involved in all that. And frankly, I think there's some good reason for it. You're not going to have fundraisers during the session anymore, because you could sometimes see the rise and fall of a bill depending on what fundraiser was held that week, which is not good. That's not the way to operate. So then you saw kind of a pushback of some of those things, and the registration requirements got more, more stringent. And I think that's a good thing. I think it's a good thing that the public knows exactly what Haley and I are doing, how much we're getting paid, what the bills are with specificity. That's a good thing, particularly now with the, I would say the faltering of the press system where, look, in those days, it was the Woodward and Bernstein era. I mean, you had these, the Post, I don't know, what they have, 4 or 5 reporters there crawling all over with magnifying glasses, as it should be. And now, great reporters with the Post, don't get me wrong, in the Sun, but you got what, 2 or 3, and they all write for each other's papers. I don't even know what I'm reading anymore. Is it the Post? Is it the Sun? the stories are in both papers. So I think, I teach a class for 20 years at Maryland in advocacy. And I tell my students this, that's not good for democracy. It's not good to see the papers fall off and the scrutiny fall off, because who's going to keep, we know who's keeping check on us, the Ethics Commission. They do a great job. I don't agree with them all the time, as you might expect, but they're not a gotcha organization. If you make a mistake, and I've made mistakes, they point it out, they fine you or whatever, and you move on. But you don't have that kind of review of the legislative process anymore. Who's watching the store? Citizens are too busy. They're dying of COVID. They're trying to keep their jobs, raise their kids, virtual schooling. Who's watching the store in Annapolis?
As Bill Zorzi always says, got to make sure they don't run off with the Capitol Dome, right?
Well, look, they're all well-meaning, hardworking legislators, but we're supposed to have these checks and balances, and the press is a big check and balance that has not been as prominent lately that needs to be.
You have raised some amazing kids. You've got Haley, which is a business owner. You've got Michael, which I understand. I have a Facebook view of the world. So like I said, Haley, I know Haley. I work for Senate President Miller and become an incredible businesswoman. Represents my good friends over there, Tessie Mays, who are the greatest of all time, right? Without clients like that, what's the point of doing this job, right?
We were just talking about them yesterday. Super, super people.
They're the greatest. I don't know where I was going. The Facebook. So then, your son was like a all America, all USA team lacrosse player out of Hopkins. Is that right?
Yeah. And sound like a father for a second, if you don't mind. He was a 3-time all American at Hopkins, won the national championship. And again, a terrific human being. He's much to my wife's chagrin, he's 33, not married and all that. Everybody's wondering what's happening with that. And every time he goes out on a date, he compares the date to my wife, which is impossible. It's an impossible, comparison. But he's in New York. Fortunately, we had him for 7 months. When New York kind of shut down, he came down here, continued his business. He's a trader, a stock and bond trader. So he continued that here virtually, but he just went back. So we miss him. He's back March 1. Middle child is Molly, who
I haven't met Molly.
Molly's tremendous. We tried to get her in this business, Haley and I, and she was going to have none of it. She said, "Dad, I want to do education policy." So she's, and I won't tell you what she said about politics, but it's not printable. But she's assistant counsel over at the University of Maryland Global Campus,
and
she loves it. She's doing intellectual property and workers' comp and whatever comes across the general counsel's desk there. She's in the bureaucracy there. She loves it. And then we have the twins, both graduated, unfortunately, are not Terps. Molly's a Terp, Haley's a Terp, I'm a Terp. They graduated from Towson, the twins. Shannon is a marketing director for cannabis one of our companies we represent, Holistic. And Jesse works for us in the office. And Jesse has two kids. Haley has four. Shannon's supposed to get married in October. So we're all, you know, doing well. We skirted the COVID so far, thank God. Kathy and I had it in October, which was a pain. But, you know, I was at a restaurant last night. We try to frequent all of our local folks here. And, you know, he said, well, you know, I didn't get it. I'm not going to get the shot. It's not that bad. And my wife said, let me tell you something. I had it in October, 104 temperature for a week, you know, almost went to the hospital. You know, it's bad. Get the shot. So,
Before I let you freestyle a little bit with what you're working on in Annapolis, I want to grab you for a dad. I'm such a clueless dad. I'm trying to get some hot tips from these people that I talk to. How do you deal with this? You know, you got young kids, mine are 11 and 7. You know, they look up to you in a certain way. But, you know, at a certain point, they're going to come to the conclusion that, you know, their parents aren't gods. And I heard this great expression that, your parents shouldn't be thought of as gods. They should be thought of as guides. And you've done such a marvelous job with all of your children and your life living in a really competitive work environment that can just be tenacious. And sometimes it can be a little evil. And I was just wondering how you were able to position yourself with your kids so that they turned out the way they did. I'd ask Greg Vedder's dad the same thing, you know?
Well, look, you have to have a foundation of faith that we try to impart. Some are more successful than others on our kids. And you have to have a sense of humor. I've made many, many mistakes, as you know, publicly and privately. And the kids have always seen our lives in total, the good and the bad. You know, no one's perfect. And if you just, and I don't want to get sappy here, but if your kids know, Damon, that you just love them unconditionally, okay? And part of that love is embodied in the time you spend with them. Nobody spends more time than you do. I mean, the wonderful ski venture I saw this last week was just stunning. And as long as you do that, I think the kids are going to turn out okay. As long as you spend the time with them and you answer their questions and you help them with the homework, all the kind of things that parents sometimes don't have time to do, you got to do it. You got to set the time aside, and that unconditional love will come through. And I think kids will turn out fine. I really believe that. It's these helicopter parents and all that. None of that works if you don't have the unconditional love.
And how do you balance like the now, obviously, you and Haley, for example, got to be sort of great buddies. How do you balance the sort of superior or hierarchical vibe that's natural between a father and a daughter to then sort of becoming friends? Is that something you started at an early age, or is that something that comes along with time?
No, I think it starts early. You know, we have the one son, and it's always great to hear him say that dad's my best friend. And I think for him, you know, he means it. And I think it's kind of a punchline for a lot of father sons. And you know, you look around in politics and sometimes there ain't the greatest relationships with family and
that's a cruel mistress. That's why I am so inspired when I see you guys doing your thing, because it's a light at the end of the tunnel. Now tell me what we are seeing from your firm this session in State Circle. Any big things you guys are working, or are you gonna keep that under your hat so we don't know what you're up to?
No, look, our my life, unfortunately, just go to Google, is an open book. So,
But we don't have any privacy anymore, Jerry. So I feel like that's what I'm just doing with my life. It's just like, you can see it. You can make fun of it. You're going to go have at it, you know?
I know. Me too. I guess the biggest thing that we're, and it's so great for the state, super for Baltimore, is this maglev project we're working on. And we've been working on it for 10 years. And it was something that Senator Mikulski had taken up in the beginning and God, do we wish we had her back as chairman of Senate Appropriations Committee, although I'm sure that the our two other senators will do great.
People don't get this. People don't get this like you did, Jerry, but we had the head of operations for the CIA. We had the head of the Senate Appropriations Committee, and we had the Speaker of the House, all from Baltimore, Maryland, there for a little while. I think it was like 2 years.
It was amazing. Yeah, no, it's just maglev will change the way we live. Few of the things we're doing in Annapolis, with all due respect, are going to change a generation from now. But if we get this maglev on track, which it is now, to go from DC to New York in under an hour changes the game and the East. I mean, if you take the economy of the Eastern Seaboard, it's the eighth largest country in the world. And if we can get, I mean, if you can wake up in Bolton Hill and work in Midtown Manhattan, get to New York in 45 minutes. I mean, it takes you longer to get to Laurel on 95.
Right. And that's what you see now with Philadelphia. You see Philadelphians working out of New York. And, you know, there was this thing in Baltimore where we treated it like a fortress for the last 50 years. All the while, people were sort of running out the back door. We were propping up our institutions. You know, we don't want University of Maryland, Baltimore to be connected with College Park. We don't want to have the maglev here and there. You know, it's like our future is our connectivity, right?
Yeah. And you know, it's a train that stops in just in center cities and airports. So we'll have a station at underneath BWI. It's about 80% underground. So it takes no homes, no businesses. It's a no-brainer. Japan, who we've been wonderful partners with and supplied, frankly, their defense over all these years since World War II, it's a gift from them, this program. It's a $6 billion transfer of intellectual property. The rest of they're going to help with the financing, and we're going to do the rest privately. So it's a no-brainer, and we've had great support. Mike and Mike were great. The current speaker's tremendous. Bill's great. We have a station in his district in Cherry Hill.
That's right. It comes right into his district.
Yeah. So it's just a phenomenal 74,000 jobs it creates. So you know, the NIMBYs are hard at work. You know, as they are with any project. I mean, I heard Kumar Barve, the transportation ENT chair, give this wonderful speech about the intercounty connector, the purple line, the Great Seneca Highway, and the tens, hundreds, maybe of millions of dollars that cost the state of Maryland in delays and lawsuits. And now their purple line, of course, is not functioning, but it will be. All these great projects now are heralded as wonderful transportation projects, but the NIMBY slowed them down so long that they cost tens and hundreds of millions of dollars in some cases of the project. So we're just fighting through it. We've got great support in Annapolis, and think what it'll do for Baltimore. Damn, you can wake up in 12 minutes, you'll be in DC working at the Capitol or wherever. Baltimore will become, you know, with the prices of homes in DC, Baltimore's housing market will explode.
That's right.
All these kids that are working on Capitol Hill, they'll all be working in Baltimore or living in Baltimore.
We invented the gosh darn trains with the B&O. We deserve it.
That's right. That's where we had our first press conference at the B&O Museum when we announced there wasn't any gnashing of teeth or moaning. We needed a labor agreement. We went to the building trades in 10 minutes, Wayne Rogers negotiated with Sean, another Marylander, Sean McGarvey, the head of the building trades, negotiated a deal, and we had an agreement for a labor agreement for the train. So we did that at B&O Museum. So you're right, the history is wonderful there.
What else you got front and center on the radar screen there for Jerry Evans?
Well, we're working on we're blessed with a lot of health clients. We have some, we represent a dental support organization, it's called. It's a new kind of way and in fact, we work cooperatively at times with Tim. He's got a client, and with Lisa. Lisa's got a client in this, on our team, if you will. So we're working together with them on a way to bring these into Maryland. A dental support organization is just a group that does the back office support for dentistry. They do the leasing and the scheduling and the lawyering and all that. They don't do anything clinical. Well, the mom and pop dentist didn't like him coming in, and they've been fighting us. And with the help of Senator West 2 years ago, we got an omnibus bill passed that sets us up as one of the models in the country for how dentists can come in and hire a DSO to do the back office stuff and not have interference into the clinical, which we never did anyway. So we're working on kind of tightening that up in a couple areas, which is exciting stuff.
That means you got the luminary Dan Daugherty. Is he on the other side of that one, right?
He's our nemesis on that. or as we call him, Dan and Fran.
Yeah, I wouldn't want them on the other side. They could be tough. But
transportation today is big. We represent all the transportation builders in the state. And there's a lot of bills in to stop, again, the NIMBY, stop the P3s on the Beltway, to stop the enlarging of the American Legion Bridge. And so we're trying to stop a lot of that from occurring so we can, again, get moving, keep transportation. Look, we're all for transit. We put together a coalition of transit folks and builders of roads, bridges, highways, and engineers, the whole gamut, to promote transit and promote keeping the roads. I don't know if you've seen our roads lately. They ain't the greatest. We've got that crazy tunnel we've got to fix, that Civil War tunnel in Baltimore. That's going to take a lot of money.
You got to check out my LinkedIn. I just did a shoot from the I just did a little selfie shoot from the harbor, from the Howard Street tunnel right there.
Oh, yeah.
Where the fire was. Yeah.
Right. And, look, we love Amtrak. Don't get us wrong. And Mark and all that. But as you know, they're running on rails and on a bed that's pre-Civil War. Right. That's why the fastest train between New York and D.C. is about 87 miles an hour, because they just can't go any faster because of the roadbed, whereas maglev's underground. And that's why we can go 320 miles an hour. So we want to work cooperatively with Amtrak and representing these builders that we do. Look, our road system's in trouble. We are, even before COVID. We were out of money. Thank God for Governor O'Malley who jammed through the gas tax, a responsible thing to do in 2013. I know
it's my fault. I think the pollster was going to blow his brains out when the governor decided to do the gas tax.
No, but look, he did it on his back. It changed the course of transportation. But the problem was, who knew back then? And we were all thinking that putting it on the wholesale price of gasoline was the way to go. Who knew the price of gasoline was going to drop?
Right.
So the money in the transportation trust fund is just not there anymore. So, and look, nobody wants to talk about taxes. I get it. Especially not now. We're coming up on election year. But these are the dues you pay to belong in a society. Do you want to run over potholes all day? Do you want to do like a slalom course, as I do on some of the roads that are in such bad shape? Or do you want a transportation system that moves?
Well, we see what happens in Virginia. I mean, I've been doing some stuff in Northern Virginia and I'm just stunned. Like, I come from the Baltimore region, at least in my head. And if we had a Volkswagen corporate headquarters circling around Baltimore, you couldn't count the number of conference calls that would go on to try to figure out what that means for the city. They dropped a 500,000 square foot headquarters in Northern Virginia. It was like another day at the office for everybody. And it's just, it's that tone. And I've been a longtime critic of Governor Hogan, which is obviously contra to your thinking and positioning. But one thing I very much enjoy about him is his tone. I mean, he gets, if you talk about this stuff in a common way that connects with people, it can really move the needle. Just your tone. Joe Biden's doing that again. We see that here at the White House. Just he and his wife at the Super Bowl halftime with the fire in the back. They had me there. You know what I mean?
No, he's, look, you mentioned Northern Virginia. Another great thing Governor O'Malley tried to do in that same bill when he passed the gas tax brilliantly. And Virginia cleans our clock in so many ways. but he put in these bills, these regional transportation authorities, like they have in Virginia, so that up in Northern Virginia, they raised taxes a little bit here, a little bit there to fund Metro. And down in the Tidewater, they have other funds for bridges and tunnels, regional transportation authorities. And they've done that forever. And Governor O'Malley tried to do it here because, look, WMATA, I read today, they're going to be in good shape because of the federal. But at some point, they got to stand on their own and all that. Well, then why not have a region, as Governor O'Malley anticipated, a regional transportation authority, Frederick, Montgomery, Prince George's, maybe even Charles, and raise money there to help WMATA rather than taking it out of the transportation trust fund. Same thing for Baltimore. Bring the Red Line back, fine. Let's have a transportation authority for Baltimore, Baltimore County, maybe even Howard, Anne Arundel, who knows. But let's raise some money for the transportation needs, the mass transportation needs there, as Governor O'Malley tried to do, almost 10 years ago.
Well, thank you for the walk down memory lane. And I think you'd have a lot of support for a regional authority up in the Baltimore area, at least. Talk to me about how your lobby, I'm going way over my time here, but
I know
you've been doing this a good amount of time. Are you enjoying this complete culture shift in lobbying? I mean, we're right here on a Zoom cast right now. I mean, how are you appreciating or yearning to get back? Talk to me about the state of play.
Yeah, look, I have to go back to Haley. I think that there has been and you know, being not really a child of the 60s, but I was 10 in 65. And, you know, back then with all the movements, you know, it's really sad and in some ways embarrassing that we're in the state we're in our country now. I mean, weren't we supposed to solve all this problem back then? I mean, isn't that where it started? And here we are, what, 50 years later, and we still have this terrible institutional racism everywhere. I mean, it's just, and I was not born.
That's a drag, isn't it? It's, you know.
Yeah, I wasn't born in that kind of a household. So I to me, it's just, it's embarrassing that we are where we are.
We all get swept up in it somehow, and then we're realizing we're a part of something that's sort of greater and not as good as us, right? Or the way we were raised, you know?
Talk to
me about it.
Yeah, to get back to your question. So I think we have to take more active roles. It's not enough just to be a good person and say you're a good person and teach your kids to be good people. You know, we have to do something, David. This can't stand where we are now. And so part of that is, you know, and I'm pressing Haley, and I don't know whether she's, you know, is uncomfortable or appreciates this or not. But again, we reformed the firm. It's her firm now. She owns it. So if you look at those top 10, and I love the piece you did about Lisa, who's been a trailblazer. You shouldn't have a firm, a top 10 dominated by white males. You know, you have to take aggressive action. I hope we are. And you know, one day you're not going to be calling me, you're going to be calling Haley. And so that top 10 of lobbyists has to look more like our country than just the same white male dominated group, which it's been forever. So, yeah, you can't just talk about it. You got to do things. So,
talk to me. You have like the top man for Verizon, Tab, is in your firm. He's a longtime operative in the communications business, well respected. You got Haley, you got another, and then you got another young person as well, right?
We have another lawyer, Rachel Birch, who now got married, and I keep calling her Birch, but her name's Clark now. She graduated from University of Maryland Law and a very a brilliant lawyer, and has a concentration at Maryland in environmental law. She does a terrific job. We had a woman named Montana Williams, African-American from Prince George's County. She we literally hired her right before COVID. She did a wonderful job. She got an opportunity for a fellowship, more money in D.C., which she loves. And so she's gone there for a year. We hope to get her back. But, you know, we're very lucky to be where we are. I mean, we've got a great cadre of clients that have been with us many for 10, 15 years. And, you know, clients, they want not necessarily, you know, wins all the time, because nobody wins. I don't care what you say about that top 10 list. You know, there are wins and there are losses. You know, you have to be able to, and in politics and in lobbying, don't take anything personally. This is not about
it's
you.
Hard. It's hard.
Yeah, it is. But it's not when you know, I teach my kids in my class, the same legislator you're fighting with today, and I was fighting with one this morning about a bill, trying to get her to drop it. You're fighting with, you're going to be, you know, coalescing with in the afternoon on another bill. So if I see a fault in some lobbyists, it's taking stuff personally. It's not personal. It's like the Godfather. It's business. It's not personal. So and the other great line you got to remember from cinema, we've had so much instructive life lessons in cinema, is that scene from Animal House, Damien, where you know, you trusted me, right? Remember, he takes the guy's car and says, we promise it's not going to get messed up. Just let us borrow it. And so you get home and the car's completely totaled. The guy's crying. And he said, you know, why'd you do that? I said, you messed up. You trusted us. So, you know, when you trust legislators, they promise they're going to do A, B, and C on a bill. You just have to understand things may shift. A bill that we thought was dead this week for Friday is now on a voting list for Friday. So we're scrambling around, Haley and I, the last 24 hours trying to get it derailed. But it's not personal. It's not, you know, an affront to Jerry Evans or Haley Evans. It just, things happen, and just roll with the punches.
Well, we've got St. Patrick's Day coming up. You're 65% Irish. You sound 100% to me. I'm scared to take the test because I know it's going to say I'm 7%, you know. That would break me in two. But I can't thank you enough for joining us today.
Thank you. It was an honor, and I had a lot of fun. And we keep watching your stuff. Keep doing the great work you're doing.
Well, I'm following you, my man, following you. Thank you for everything you're doing, and we're so excited to have you here on Center Maryland.
Thanks so much.
All right, man, thank you.
Bye-bye.